You're listening to The Jewish Truth Bomb with Lenny Goldberg.
Hey, this is Lenny Goldberg, and thanks for joining me today. The war in Gaza, of course, rages on. This past week, more Israeli soldiers killed, others wounded during fighting, mostly in southern Gaza. And since late October, the toll of slain troops in the ground offensive against the Hamas is 247. We are being shackled both by our own government and the Biden administration, not to finish off the job, not to conquer Rafiah. And so this war is turning out like all the other wars turned out when we went into Gaza. All the other operations where we went in halfway, we killed some terrorist leaders, blew up some buildings, and then we left until the next time we had to go in. You see, we were all hoping that this time would be different. We're all figuring that if thousands of Hamas-led Arabs launch a murderous rampage like they did on October 7th, killing 1,200 people, raping and mutilating as they go, seizing 253 hostages, we were all hoping that maybe now it'll be a little bit different. Maybe now we'll actually fight this war the way it's supposed to be fought and just finish them off already. And to hell with the world. Yeah, we were hoping somehow maybe it'll be different this time, but it's not. We're stuck in the same mud. We act the same way in relation to the civilian casualties. We don't want to hurt any innocent Arabs, so to speak. Same thing. You know it's bad when we're getting accolades by people who love us, like the British Colonel Richard Kemp, who's proud of us that we try so hard to minimize the civilian deaths when we're fighting in Gaza. When you're getting praise like that, you know you're in big trouble. Because it means that Jewish soldiers are being put in harm's way. Jews are willing to put their soldiers in danger just so they can get the compliments that no other army has gone so far to minimize the loss of civilian life in Gaza. That's what our friends are saying about us. That's why they like us so much, appreciate us, that we're so moral. So what this really means is that we're sacrificing our boys on the altar of what will the nation say about us. We need them to continue to say what a moral army we are. This is the same mentality we've had throughout in all our excursions into Gaza and even back in the Lebanon War. And regarding the war in Lebanon back in the 80s, I want to read just a little bit of a story where you see this complaint of a high-ranking army officer all about the efforts to impose this perverted morality on the Israeli soldiers. And so I'm going to read now what this army officer wrote concerning the war in Lebanon. He says like this: "I know how many efforts we dedicated in Lebanon to keep from harming civilians. I state categorically that the army had tens of casualties, if not more, only because of the order not to harm civilians. In general, during a war, one first softens a target with artillery in order to prevent casualties among your own soldiers. But here, they didn't allow us to do that, lest we hit civilians. From the time we entered Lebanon, we adhered strictly to the orders not to fire on targets where there was a civilian center. We would hand out flyers and warn them by loudspeakers. Does this sound familiar? If not for that, we could have advanced more swiftly to crush the terrorist strongholds and, most important, saved ourselves tens of our own casualties." And so what he's saying here is exactly what happens in Gaza. They know we're coming. We wait and we wait. We warn them we're coming, and they could prepare for us. And he continues, "The terrorists knew this and they entered civilian centers. We could do nothing because of the stubborn orders of Raful and General Amos Yaron not to fire, even when we were positive that terrorists had penetrated a certain area. Where is the red line that determines for a commander which is more important, to preserve the lives of his soldiers or to save civilians, part of whom are aiding the terrorists? It appears to me that the Israeli commanders have long since crossed this red line in favor of preserving the lives of foreign civilians, even at the cost of casualties amongst our soldiers." Now again, this was written a long time ago during the Lebanon War, and at that time we had a great chief of staff. If you're going to compare it to Gallant, we had Raful Eitan. Raful Eitan was no friar, but we see that even when Raful Eitan, who really is a hawk, who has the reputation of doing what he wants and not what the world wants or the leftist media wants, he too put our soldiers in harm's way in order not to kill innocent civilians in Lebanon. Now, Raful Eitan, like I said, he's no Yoav Gallant or Eisenkot or Gantz. But he had been the target of such leftist propaganda in Israel's sick news media. They never let up for a day in their self-hating campaign. And they were putting constant pressure on the military. Plus, you had that group, the Arba Imahot, the four mothers, and every day they're pounding away, talking about the innocent civilians and the Jewish soldiers that are being killed. It became our Vietnam. And so the chief of staff, Raful Eitan, so condemned by the leftists as this brutal hawk, such a brutal hawk, they called him, he collapsed before the Hellenist onslaught, and he gave these orders not to shell terrorist bases in civilian areas, lest we, God forbid, cause Arab civilian casualties. Far better that our own boys die. And so it's no surprise today what's going on, because you don't have Raful Eitan. You have instead Gallant, Bibi, Gantz, and other Yafei Nefesh. Plus you have the same media, plus you have the pressure from the Biden administration. So of course we're not going to do what we have to do in Gaza. Rabbi Kahane used to say that the life of one Jewish soldier was worth more than those of all the Arabs, soldiers, terrorists, civilians, doesn't matter who, in Lebanon. And he would long for the day of normalcy in World War II when normal Gentiles of the United States and British Air Forces, knowing, unless the German back and morale was shattered, they would bomb German cities with their civilians inside without mercy. Because they knew that they were fighting a war against an enemy that if they won, they would plunge the world into a nightmare. And so they never invented this madness called purity of arms, because arms, they're not pure. Arms are to kill your enemy. And if not, then don't go to war in the first place. And so as the rabbi used to say, we're trying to be better than them. Yeah, better, but deader. So what's the root of this? Why do we not only warp Judaism, but we twist just common logic and common sense? This contradicts all rules of self-preservation, especially knowing what the Arabs did to us on October 7th. You'd think we'd finish them off for now. And it's not just the pressure from America and from the left in Israel. And by the way, a lot of that pressure comes in the form of bring them home, bring the hostages home. That's another way of saying that the priority of this war is not to wipe out the Hamas, but bring the hostages home. That's their trick. But getting back to the question, what causes these people to go against such common sense? And Rabbi Kahane used to explain it, that it really all goes back to this sick legacy of the ghetto, the exile, and this need to be loved. We so want to be loved that we're willing to die, and then we can prove to the Gentile how immoral we are. And that way he can love us posthumously. So that's what really stands behind this whole purity of arms crap. It's as if to say, look how moral we are. Look how good we are. We're willing to have our own boys killed so we don't kill innocent civilians. You see what a wonderful people we are? Can you love us now, please? Posthumously, anyway? That's what stands behind it. It's the ghetto Jew looking for love in all the wrong places. And so there's nothing moral about it. It's a complex. It's a complex that no other nation has. That's why no other nation even takes this into consideration. Did Harry Truman give a damn about innocent civilians when he bombed Japan? Nobody even records the amount of innocent civilians in wars. Does anybody know how many civilians were killed in Vietnam? Only with us. But it's not just pressure from the outside. We do it to ourselves because we want to be loved. We are better than them. Deader, but better. And so we send trucks into Gaza by the hundreds, humanitarian aid. When we capture terrorists, we feed them and allow them all the benefits. And then we free them in a hostage exchange. And when you free these terrorists, nothing in the world can better assure the future murder of Jews. But we don't even think that far ahead. Now, what's the great irony in this, in the measure for measure? Is that we don't do what we're supposed to do. And we get blamed for it anyway. We're trying to be the most moral army in the world, taking into account civilian casualties, something no other army does. And we're still getting blamed for being genocidal. That's what they're yelling at us all the time, all the leftists. They're chasing down Jerry Seinfeld, that he supports genocide. That's the word they're using, genocide. That's what they say about us. You support genocide. That's their chant, that we're perpetrating genocide on the Gazans. So no matter what kind of precautions we take not to kill innocent civilians, they're still saying we commit genocide. Now think about it. For the same money, we can actually finish off the job, fight this war the way we should, and we'll still be called genocidal, but at least we get the benefits of it. And notice also, when you see those demonstrations in America against Israel, it's very well organized and they have a very clear message. And their messaging is well thought out. What they're doing is they're revving up the discussion. It always used to be that people didn't like Israel. Israel should give back the territories. Israel doesn't give rights to Palestinians. You always had that. But what you have now is the concept that Israel shouldn't be at all, from the river to the sea. It should not be. Because Israel is a country of European Ashkenazim, white people, white privilege, who took over the Middle East after the Holocaust. They came here after the Holocaust and took away the country from the poor Arabs who were here. That's what they're saying now. Israel doesn't have a right to exist at all. So you see, there's a new level in their rhetoric because, again, they know how to do propaganda. And in their innocuous way, they know how to eat away at what was the norm, just like the norm of what a family is. It's a mother, it's a father, all those simple values that were taken for granted, such as not having drag shows for kindergarten kids or not having an abortion in the 9th month. Whatever they do, they break every single norm, anything normal that was, that you take for granted. They slowly but surely break with all convention and make the aberration into the norm. And so the same thing is going on with the propaganda war against Israel. And so they're easy prey for the college students. You see them also at the demonstrations, because the average college student, he's so dumbed down anyway. He knows nothing about Israel's history, about world history. So he can easily be convinced, because he doesn't really care about history anyway. It's a selfish generation. The world began when I was born. He doesn't care about history. Everything starts with me. Now, it used to be that Israel had a Hasbara department where they would invest in explaining their position, give the history of the region, the short-term history, the long-term history, and educate people on the Jewish rights to our homeland. But that department doesn't exist anymore. So there's really nothing to counter the Arab narrative. So these kids get absolutely nothing from anywhere. There's no Rabbi Kahana to come into their campus and to explain it. You do have a few warriors like Ben Shapiro, but they really have no way to hear another voice. And so all these campuses are the same. It's not just Harvard. Harvard is just famous because they're Harvard. But all the schools are that way. Anti-Israel, anti-Jew. Even Abe Foxman, the former ADL head, is talking about how scary it is what's going on in America. So Israel is sacrificing its soldiers on the altar of world opinion, and they hate us anyway. And so that's what we call measure for measure. You're looking for the world to love you, and you don't want to harm innocents, and they still call it genocide. If one learned the Torah properly, and he would see how King David or how Joshua fought against the enemy, he would realize how a Jewish war is fought and what an astounding difference between the morality of true Judaism and the perverted ethics of the schizophrenic Jews. And what's sad is that they take their gentilized concepts and their Hellenism and they trumpet that as Judaism, as if it's according to Judaism that you have to deliberately sacrifice your soldiers in order to save the enemy who's not in uniform. And that brings me to the Haggadah of the Jewish idea, which straightens out the Jewish concepts in our head so we know what's Jewish and what's gentilized, what is chametz and what's matzah. And I want to read now part of the introduction of the Haggadah of the Jewish idea, written by Binyamin Zev Kahana. The purpose of the Haggadah of the Jewish idea is not merely to add yet another Haggadah to the collection of Haggadot already available to the public. Its purpose is rather to present the concepts of faith in God on this holy night, the Seder night, which is ordained as the night which would define the faith of the Jew. There is no task more important today than rectifying those most fundamental Jewish concepts, indeed, particularly among B'nai Torah, Torah scholars. For not only has our long exile caused us to forget the very soul of Judaism and the Jewish idea, more than that, foreign cultures have penetrated deep into our collective psyche, including into the halls of Torah, emasculating our ideology. So widespread have these phenomena become that few today are capable of differentiating between matzah and chametz, between Jewish ideas and foreign ideas. Similarly, at the core of the necessity of this Haggadah stands the fact that many Jews sit at the Seder table in order to fulfill the mitzvah of the night, which is to recount the Exodus from Egypt, but find themselves entirely dependent upon vorts, which have only the slightest connections with the message of Passover, or indeed the teachings of Judaism in general. Now listen to this. During the months of work writing this commentary, I was honored to be harassed by the authorities, especially when they chose precisely this time to carry out an intensive interrogation against me. I was accused of the crime of writing various commentaries on the Torah. Incitement, by the definition. Indeed, this Haggadah too was saved from falling into their clutches only by the grace of God. I was but a step away from being forcibly prevented from publishing this commentary in time for Passover of this year, 1997. However, it was precisely this fact that ultimately gave me the added strength and impetus necessary to complete this work, to publish this Haggadah, and to spread the authentic Jewish idea among the Jewish people, despite those who desire to delegitimize and ban the truth and to prevent us from speaking the truth. Okay, so if that's not enough to want you to buy this Haggadah, I don't know what is. And I'll tell you how to order it in a minute at the end of this broadcast, but I want to say a couple of things. I was very close to Binyamin Kahana during those harassments and arrests and seizures of his computer and so forth. And he mentions here that it was a coincidence, but the Shin Bet was precisely at the time he was trying to finish the Haggadah, they were carrying out their investigation. What does that mean, investigation? They're ransacking his house, confiscating his computer, confiscating his mailing list and his list of activists, maybe arresting him for a couple of days, interrogating him, maybe putting him in jail. And so what happened was, when he felt the heat of the investigation, he put his Haggadah commentary on a floppy disk. Remember those days when we had those floppy disks? So he had it on a floppy disk in case they take his computer. And sure enough, hours later, the police came, the Shin Bet came, right outside his house. He was my neighbor. I saw the police there all the time. And they took his computer and all kinds of other goodies for a full-scale investigation of Binyamin Kahana, the insider. But like I said, he had the floppy disk and he finished it on my computer. And so that was a great privilege for me. But the thing is, he was really worried about being arrested. Not that he cared about that he was arrested, but he wouldn't be able to finish this work that he worked on very hard. And so he was actually on the run, hiding out in case they decided to arrest him. He wanted to finish it, because if they grab him and put him in prison, he can't finish it. I remember during this time, I was holding the floppy disk so that they wouldn't seize it from Rabbi Binyamin. And then we had this secret meeting at the Holy Bagel in Jerusalem on Jaffa Street. And so that's where I passed on to him the floppy disk so he could finish what he was doing. Those are the good old days. You know, I still remember drinking a cherry cola as I waited for him to show up. There's not many places you can get a cherry cola in Israel, in those days especially. That's why the Holy Bagel restaurant was the ideal place to meet. Now think about that. You're on the run for writing Torah articles, a Haggadah, commentaries, scholarly Torah works. That's why they were harassing him, because his writings had gotten out to the Israeli public. It was getting popular. And in those days, you really couldn't publicize things on the internet. You had to print it and you had to somehow circulate it. So think about this Haggadah. It's the only Haggadah you'll find where the writer is being arrested and harassed for incitement. How many Haggadahs are like that? So you know it must be insightful and inciting. If you get my drift, you know, Binyamin Kahana used to say that, yeah, I'm inciting people to think. But you still have to wonder, why do the authorities go after him? They don't bother anybody else writing a commentary on their gutter. So that's the thing. If the Torah you're teaching in your yeshiva or in the study hall, if you're teaching or writing about Torah on a personal level, if you're teaching the laws of Shabbat or of ritual purity, that's not going to scare them. That's not a threat to them. They might not like you, but it's not a threat. But if you take that Torah and apply it to the national sector, well, that will already quicken their pulse rate. A couple of years ago, there was a book published by the rabbis from the Shiva of Od Yosef Chai in Yitzhar. It was called Torat HaMelech, the Torah of the King. And it was all about the subject of the laws of kings, of a sovereign state, the laws of war, who you can kill, who you can't kill. A total scholarly book. I mean, even if the Shin Bet confiscated this book, which they did, they wouldn't understand it because it's full of sources. I mean, it's not the kind of material they're used to investigating. But they knew that this kind of book or this kind of yeshiva infringes on their turf because it's talking about the national issues. It's national in scope. It's talking about how to run a country. So what did the Israeli authorities do? Well, the army actually seized the yeshiva of Od Yosef Chai in Yitzhar. They actually transformed the yeshiva into an army base for many, many months. And that was a precedent. People couldn't believe it. That they actually used the Beit Midrash for an army base. It was pretty disgusting. Now, why don't they do that to, let's say, Panovich, a yeshiva in Bnei Brak? Because Panovich isn't a threat. They might not like those boys learning Torah. They might not appreciate them. But for them, the most important thing is that you don't interfere in their stuff, in the national aspects, like wars, and what does the Torah have to say about Arabs and Eretz Yisrael, building the temple, and all that kind of national stuff. And that's why they're not afraid of Aguda and Shas, those Haredi parties. The Haredi parties may annoy them. They might even hate them. But they're not a threat, because these are parties with no national aspirations. You got Aguda, you got Shas. They're religious parties, but they're not looking to rule. All they're doing is using the system to get more budgets and allocation of monies and funds for their institutions, to spread Torah in Israel. Good things, but the Torah they're spreading is of the individual. Their Torah doesn't enter the national sphere. I'll give you an example. Let's say somehow the majority of Israel somehow voted Aguda or Shas as the largest party in Israel, and the prime minister was from one of these Haredi parties, Aguda or Shas. They are now the party with the most votes, and their head is the prime minister of Israel. That would be hilarious, because they don't want to be prime minister of Israel. They're not there for that. They're not in the Knesset for that. Things like foreign policy and what are you doing, the war with Gaza and strategies, that's not their field. But for those rabbis and scholars and yeshivas that emphasize the national aspects of Torah, the land of Israel, fighting the wars, building the temple, the Israeli authorities fear that more than they fear fundamental Islam. It's fundamental Judaism that really gives them the scare. And that's why they have a war on the hilltop youth, those Jews with the payas, because those are the proud Jews with earlocks and proud to be Jews. They're out there participating in the national life of Israel. They're out there settling the land, dealing with their Arab neighbors the way you're supposed to. And so they become the major target. I don't want to be solely focused on discussing every week, you know, the national issues. I mean, how much can I talk about the need to wipe out the enemy, we'll call them? You know who I mean. And so I want to do what I used to do on the podcast and talk about things that are more personal. Torah insights on, let's say, a personal level. And so looking at these last Parshat Shavuos that we've had on the tabernacle in the book of Exodus, there was something called Ner Tamid, an eternal flame that burned constantly on the golden menorah. It's called a Ner Tamid, a candle that was lit all the time. From the word Tamid, Tamid means always. Now the term for someone who sits and he learns Torah a lot, sits in the Beit Midrash, it's called a Matmid. What's a Matmid? From the word Tamid, he's always learning it. So people think it's someone, he's learning Torah all the time. He's learning Torah 24/7. He's a Matmid. Tamid, he's learning Torah. You picture somebody who's sitting in his place in the Beit Midrash and he doesn't move. But that's not really what a Matmid is. A Matmid is someone who always, he sticks to his schedule. He's got a routine. He gets up early. He has a Seder. He has an organized learning regimen. He gets up to eat at the same time. Doesn't take shortcuts. The thing about the Matmid is his kfiut. He's consistent. That's a Matmid. He's consistent. He sticks to his routine. Just like a Ner Tamid, the light is consistently burning. He's on time. He doesn't miss things. A Matmid, he has a routine and he sticks to it. So why am I bringing this up? Well, my father passed away this past December, and now I have to say the Mourner's Kaddish during the prayers three times a day, Shachris, Mincha, and Mariv. You have to say Kaddish, and you need a minyan. You need 10 Jews praying together, and then you can say Kaddish. And so for me, before my father passed away and I wasn't obligated to say Kaddish, I always tried to make the minyan. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't make the minyan. If I didn't, I pray at home. If I'm feeling lazy or it's too cold or I'm not feeling that great. But not now. because I don't want to miss saying Kaddish. And so I never miss a minyan anymore because I want to do it for my father. So what I want to say is this. It used to be that when Mincha Mariv rolled around, I'm debating to myself every time, mulling it over. Should I go to the minyan? Maybe I'll stay home. If I'm on a job, I'm not home. How am I going to get to the minyan? Maybe I'll skip it this time and pray, you know, a quickie in the street. Or maybe I'm in Givat Ronin for Shabbat, this hilltop where my daughter lives, and the shul is like 2 miles away up a rocky cliff. You know, maybe I'll stay home for Mincha. But not anymore, at least for these 11 months of Kaddish. That is, I know I'm going to the minyan. It's not negotiable anymore. It used to be negotiable. It's not negotiable. I'm not going to ponder anymore whether to go to shul or not. I'm going. And what I want to say is, that's a great place to be when you know you're going to do something and it's not a question anymore in your mind. You're not deciding what you're going to do. I've noticed that it wastes a lot of mental energy as well. When you're always trying to decide, should I stay or should I go? It's actually a waste of energy to mull this over. But when you've decided already, you've decided, it's not a question. It's not negotiable. It's such a relief. Your mind is much more relaxed now because it's not negotiable anymore. And I'm using this example of saying Kaddish, but it applies for everything. It's very beneficial to make certain things, important things, non-negotiable, something that you know you're going to do it and it doesn't matter and no questions asked. It could be a shiur, or let's say your mother or your father call you and sometimes you might not be in the mood. And maybe they need you for something and you don't know if you should do it or not. You don't have time. But if you take a stand now and you know that regarding this particular issue, no deliberating over it, you're not deciding in your head anymore, should I go, should I not go, should I speak to them, should I not? No, you're going to do it. What do you mean you don't have time? You're going to make time. This is a priority. If they call, you put everything down and you say, now I'm going to spend time with my mother and my father. That's my priority. No questions asked. You see, that's a great place to be. You're being a matmid. You're being consistent. And you'll see that when you do that, that is, you make certain things non-negotiable. You're not deciding anymore. Should I? Shouldn't I? That's when you get the bracha. The blessings come on those things that are non-negotiable, that you're not deciding. Yes, no. It's the things that you say, this I'm doing, doesn't matter. That's when the blessings start to kick in. So that's it for me. Don't forget to order the Haggadah, the Jewish idea. I read to you part of the introduction. I don't know how you can resist. I guarantee you, you're going to have a wonderful and meaningful Passover with this Haggadah. The best way to order it is writing me an email, LennyGoldberg40@gmail.com. Lenny Goldberg, the number 40@gmail.com. Order it right away. I'll send it to you. This is a can't miss. Believe me, I'm losing money on this and time. I'm dodging bullets on my way to the post office. Just kidding. I'm going to send you that Haggadah because I want it to get out. So just order it. I know you're going to love it. And I'll be back next week.